Today you're going to have another environmentally friendly message, recycled from last year. Zephaniah, it's one of those little books tucked away at the end of the Old Testament. But what's it all about? Well, Zephaniah was a contemporary of Jeremiah. And Zephaniah is the first, or maybe the second, depending on the dating of Nahum. It's the first of a series of prophets whose job it was to warn the people of Judah and give them an opportunity to escape the same fate of the northern kingdom that had already been deported by the Assyrians. And the other prophets in that series were Jeremiah, Habakkuk, Obadiah, Ezekiel, and Nahum. The people of Judah were engaging in awful apostasy. They had picked up other religions and mixed them with their worship of Yahweh. Superstition and the worship of the stars had become the norm, and even human sacrifice is mentioned. Now, part of all this syncretism was associated with the fact that Israel, or Judah, was a vassal state of Assyria, but that was no excuse. To fully grasp the behaviour of the people and the leaders of Judah is to appreciate the incredible patience of God in not wiping them out altogether. Instead, though, God has a plan to fix the problem. It's going to be painful, but it will work. The people have a few decades, it's a fairly long time in human terms, to come good and avoid the painful option of punishment. It's estimated that this prophecy was given around about 627 BC. This is about 70 years after Isaiah and Micah. 6 years later, in 621 BC, Josiah implemented significant religious reforms, possibly partly as a result of the preaching of Zephaniah. But unfortunately, the reforms don't outlast Josiah, and the people fell away from their God again. And eventually, 40 years later, in 587 BC, God brought about the punishment that had been prophesied. Jerusalem is sacked by the Babylonians and the people deported. So that's where we are. We're going to have a run through Zephaniah. We're going to read through the whole book and just look at some commentary along the way. The word of the Lord came to Zephaniah, son of Cushi, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hezekiah, during the reign of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah. Zephaniah introduces himself with a genealogy going back four generations, and this is unusually lengthy. How many people know their grandfather's father's name? It is likely that the Hezekiah mentioned was King Hezekiah, who was an ancestor to be proud of. So that may be why he goes back four generations. There's another possibility, which is also related to the fact that his father's name, Cushi, means Ethiopian, and Zephaniah might have wanted to demonstrate more than three generations of Jewish pedigree in case someone charged that he wasn't really Jewish. And if you refer back to Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 8, you can read more about that. I will sweep away everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will sweep away both people and animals. I will sweep away the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea and the idols that cause the wicked to stumble. Both here and again in 1 verse 18, God talks about the whole earth. And this can be a bit confusing when trying to piece this all together. The rest of the passage seems to be talking about a time that we can recognise, but God didn't wipe out everything in the earth at that time. So what gives? The answer is that the prophets were given a view of the future, which was like looking towards the horizon through a telescope or binoculars. What happens when you survey the horizon using a telescope is that the near and distant tend to merge. Hence, while the prophet is talking about something in the more immediate future, he occasionally happens to use wording that relates to things that are in the same field of view but are actually in the more distant future. They are related in theme, but not in time. Hopefully that makes sense. When I destroy all people on the face of the earth, declares the Lord, I will stretch out my hand against Judah and against all who live in Jerusalem. I will destroy every remnant of Baal worship in this place, every remembrance of the idolatrous priests, those who bow down on the roofs to worship the starry host, those who bow down and swear by the Lord and who also swear by Moloch, those who turn back from following the Lord and neither seek the Lord nor inquire of him. So all the bad things that were happening weren't happening in quiet corners of Judah. Jerusalem, the capital, led the way and is therefore singled out for special treatment. Every remnant of Baal worship was to be wiped out and the idolatrous priests must disappear. There was an incredible persistence of Canaanite religion in Jewish worship. The worship of their God, Yahweh, kept on getting seriously corrupted. It was just like a disease that just wouldn't go away. Be silent before the sovereign Lord, for the day of the Lord is near. The Lord has prepared a sacrifice. He has consecrated those he has invited. On the day of the Lord's sacrifice, I will punish the officials and the king's sons and all those clad in foreign clothes. Just as a note, the foreign clothes indicates that the princes and officials were getting mixed up, and they're getting mixed up with foreign practices, undoubtedly both ethically as well as religiously. And the clothing was just simply an outward indication of what they were doing. On that day, I will punish all who avoid stepping on the threshold, who fill the temple of their gods with violence and deceit. Now, this is believed to be a reference to pagan superstition. The threshold of a house where you go through the doorway was considered the domain of household gods who guarded the house. People would step over the threshold as an act of superstition, a bit like some people might superstitiously avoid stepping on cracks in the footpath. God hates superstition. On that day, declares the Lord, a cry will go up from the fish gate, wailing from the new quarter, and a loud crash from the hills. Wail, you who live in the market district. All your merchants will be wiped out. All who trade with silver will be destroyed. At that time, I will search Jerusalem with lamps and punish those who are complacent, who are like wine left on its dregs, who think the Lord will do nothing, either good or bad. And there's this allusion to winemaking here, and that is that wine must not be allowed to settle. If it is, it thickens with sediment. It has to be periodically poured, decanted from one vessel to another in order for it to mature properly. And this is the same as the complacency that leads to moral decay. That's the picture that's been painted. Their wealth will be plundered, their houses demolished. Though they build houses, they will not live in them. Though they plant vineyards, they will not drink the wine. The great day of the Lord is near, near and coming quickly. The cry on the day of the Lord is bitter. The mighty warrior shouts his battle cry. There's this term, the day of the Lord. And the day of the Lord is a term that's used in about 16 Old Testament passages, and it's a whole subject in itself. The event in question might seem only locally significant, or it might be nationally significant, or it might be universally significant in the spiritual realm. The key point to remember here, though, is that God's anger is aroused by worship of other deities. God will eventually respond with wrath. God isn't some benign character who's always smiling and indifferent to what people do. He does get angry and he does punish. That day will be a day of wrath, a day of distress and anguish, a day of trouble and ruin, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and blackness, a day of trumpet and battle cry against the fortified cities and against the corner towers. I will bring such distress on all people that they will grope about like those who are blind because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood will be poured out like dust and their entrails like dung. Neither their silver nor their gold will be able to save them on the day of the Lord's wrath. In the fire of his jealousy, the whole earth will be consumed, for he will make a sudden end of all who live on the earth. Strong words. When the wrath of God takes place, people who think that they can live independently of God soon find out that they're as helpless as a blind man to get out of the way. The futility of a godless existence is brought out in this imagery of dust and dung. Gather together, gather yourselves together, you shameful nation, before the decree takes effect and that day passes like wind-blown chaff, before the Lord's fierce anger comes upon you, before the day of the Lord's wrath comes on you. So in the midst of all this denunciation and warning, Zephaniah essentially says, get a grip on yourselves before it's too late. There's a gleam of hope. There's a ray of light. And the next verse is particularly significant. Seek the Lord, all you humble of the land, you who do what he commands. Seek righteousness, seek humility. Perhaps you will be sheltered on the day of the Lord's anger. Zephaniah has been addressing those who are turning away from God, and now he addresses those who are right with God and aren't doing all the bad things that God hates. And the implication of the message is that just because they do what God commands and are humble doesn't mean that they won't be swept up in the collective turmoil that is to come. There is no certainty, but there is the offer of the possibility that they could be sheltered on the day of the Lord's anger. And this is an important message. It's as important for us today as it was then. Whatever evil is going on in our society, if we see ourselves as being right with God and not party to what's going on, we shouldn't presume that we will be insulated from the consequences in this world. And I'm talking about within the earthly realms, not in the heavenly realms. God commands us to seek righteousness and humility, and perhaps God will, in his mercy, shelter us from the consequences of the evil of the world in our society. Gaza will be abandoned and Ashkelon left in ruins. At midday, Ashdod will be emptied and Ekron uprooted. Woe to you who live by the sea, you Kerethite people. The word of the Lord is against you, Canaan, land of the Philistines. He says, I will destroy you and none will be left. So next, God pronounces judgment on the nations surrounding Judah. The proud who oppose God will be humiliated, regardless of whether they are in Judah or are Judah's neighbours. The land by the sea will become pastures, having wells for shepherds and pens for flocks. That land will belong to the remnant of the house of Judah. There they will find pasture. In the evening they will lie down in the houses of Ashkelon. The Lord their God will care for them. He will restore their fortunes. Zephaniah is now looking beyond the catastrophe to where the remnant will return and reoccupy the land. This remnant gets mentioned again in chapter 2, verse 9 and 3, 12 and 13. Note the comparison here, that there's a judgment that's pronounced on both the people of God and their neighbours alike. They're both coming under judgment, but only for the people of Judah does God preserve a remnant. Here we get this picture of the restoration. The Lord their God will care for them. Now, of course, after the return of the exiles, things don't always go perfectly well, but the people are preserved and their idolatry is purged. And if the faithful had been able to see the whole picture, which some of them might have, the exile might have been seen in advance to them as a good thing. They would have been frustrated by the nation's political and religious leaders who wouldn't be faithful to God. In 2 Kings chapter 21, verse 16, for example, it describes Manasseh also shed so much innocent blood that he filled Jerusalem from end to end, besides the sin that he had caused Judah to commit, so that they did evil in the eyes of the Lord. The exile that was coming would remove these types of people and their degrading influence, and those dark days of idolatry and dreadful evil would not return. I have heard the insults of Moab and the taunts of the Ammonites who insult my people and make threats against their land. Therefore, as surely as I live, declares the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, surely Moab will become like Sodom, the Ammonites like Gomorrah, a place of weeds and salt pits, a wasteland forever. The remnant of my people will plunder them. The survivors of my nation will inherit their land. This is what they will get in return for their pride, for insulting and mocking the people of the Lord Almighty. The Lord will be awesome to them when he destroys all the gods of the earth. Distant nations will bow down to him, all of them in their own lands. Note that God does not tolerate others insulting and taunting his people, even when they have been at their worst. The wording here indicates that this is a serious offence. And I suggest that the same is true today. But also this mention of distant nations will bow down to him, all of them in their own lands. We here today are part of the fulfillment of that prophecy and that prophetic theme that runs right through the Bible. Verse 12, you Cushites too will be slain by my sword. Now Cush was the name for Ethiopia, which, contrary to our modern perception, was actually quite a powerful empire at the time. So that's why Cush gets a special mention. He will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria, leaving Nineveh utterly desolate and dry as the desert. Flocks and herds will lie down there, creatures of every kind. The desert owl and the screech owl will roost on her columns. The hooting will echo through the windows. Rubble will fill the doorways. The beams of cedar will be exposed. This is the city of revelry that lived in safety. She said to herself, I am the one. There is none besides me. What a ruin she has become, a lair for wild beasts. All who pass by her scoff and shake their fists. So these verses, chapter 2:13-15, they parallel Nahum in prophesying the destruction of the capital city of the Assyrians, Nineveh. You remember that the Assyrians had been powerful for about 200 years. And at the time that this prophecy was made, the depiction of the prophecy would have seemed unlikely. It's a bit like saying that Washington will be abandoned and desolate. Yet the prophecy about the desolation of Nineveh would start to come true something like 15 years later, when Nineveh was destroyed by the Babylonians in 612 BC. The fact that the people would scoff and shake their fists as they walked by is probably because they didn't forget how brutal and cruel the Assyrians were. Chapter 3, attention turns back to Jerusalem. Woe to the city of oppressors, rebellious and defiled. She obeys no one. She accepts no correction. She does not trust in the Lord. She does not draw near to her God. Her officials within her are roaring lions. Her rulers are evening wolves who leave nothing for the morning. Her prophets are unprincipled. They cannot be trusted. Her priests profane the sanctuary and do violence to the law. The Lord within her is righteous. He does no wrong. Morning by morning he dispenses his justice, and every new day he does not fail. Yet the unrighteous show no shame. I have destroyed nations, their strongholds are demolished. I have left their streets deserted with no one passing through. Their cities are laid waste, they are deserted and empty. Of Jerusalem I thought, "Surely you will fear me and accept correction. Then her place of refuge would not be destroyed, nor all my punishments come upon her." But they were still eager to act corruptly in all they did. So God lists a catalogue of sins. This time the emphasis is different. Earlier on, the emphasis was on the sins of idolatry. Now the focus is on social sins, corruption and unethical behaviour. And he points out that he has demonstrated what he does to others who are opposed to him. But still, they don't take notice. In verse 7, note again here that God's judgment on his people is not a completely foregone conclusion. Unlike the other nations, God gives them an option. He's particularly merciful on those who are his. The problem was that his people were still eager to act corruptly in all they did, and also hadn't turned and sought his mercy. "Therefore wait for me, declares the Lord, for the day I will stand up and to testify. I have decided to assemble the nations, to gather the kingdoms, and to pour out my wrath on them, all my fierce anger. The whole world will be consumed by the fire of my jealous anger." Again, Zephaniah's prophecy is telescoping the near and the distant. There's a hint of apocalypse that's coming through in this passage. In the verses that follow, 9 to 13, God will purify, and this is the purpose of the punishment. The purifying is related to calling upon God, and this is in contrast to before, where the people did not call upon their God, or at least they did so at the same time as they called upon other gods as well. And a similar pattern to the announcement of judgment in chapter 1, verses 2 to 6, is repeated in the announcement of restoration. First of all, there is reference to a worldwide scope of proper worship, and then there is focus on Jerusalem. "Then I will purify the lips of the peoples, that all of them may call on the name of the Lord and serve him shoulder to shoulder. From beyond the rivers of Cush, my worshippers, my scattered people, will bring offerings." So beyond the rivers of Cush was like to the ends of the earth. In today's language, it might be saying from here to Timbuktu. "On that day, you, Jerusalem, will not be put to shame for all the wrongs you have done to me, because I will remove from you those who revel in your glory. Never again will you be haughty on my holy hill." So that God will remove from you those who revel in your glory. Never again will you be haughty on my holy hill. The purpose of the punishment and the exile, it's a little bit like the 40 years of wandering in the desert. It will remove the people who are subject to judgment. "But I will leave within you the meek and humble. The remnant of Israel will trust in the name of the Lord. They will do no wrong. They will tell no lies. A deceitful tongue will not be found in their mouths. They will eat and lie down, and no one will make them afraid." So 12 and 13 go on to state that not only will he remove the bad eggs, but those he will leave within Israel will be meek and humble, and they will trust in the name of the Lord. And the word that's translated humble here is one is about one who is humbled by misfortune. In chapter 2, verse 3, there's also the word humble, but that's a different Hebrew word, which means one who is humble in character. So the exile would change people's attitudes. Only a select few would inherit the renewed nation. So putting it another way, the inheritance, the promise of salvation, was not at a national level. It wasn't for everyone and every family that was there before. It was at a personal level, and it was characterized by the attitude before God of the individual. Now again, of course, the remnant weren't completely perfect and they didn't live in complete peace ever after. But there's a certain amount of hyperbole here, I suggest, and also prophetical telescoping pointing to an eschatological image. And it's also the truth that those who trust in God and do all of these things will not be afraid of anyone. Verses 14 to 20 paints a picture of the new relationship between God and his people, and to extent it's self-explanatory. Sing, daughter Zion, shout aloud, Israel, be glad and rejoice with all your heart, daughter Jerusalem. The Lord has taken away your punishment. He has turned back your enemy. So, like a kingly judge giving acquittal. The Lord, the King of Israel, is with you. Never again will you fear harm. So God will drive out the enemies of Israel. On that day they will say to Jerusalem, do not fear, Zion. Do not let your hands hang limp. The Lord your God is with you, the mighty warrior who saves. So God will guarantee their security. He will take great delight in you. In his love he will no longer rebuke you, but will rejoice over you with singing. I will remove from you all who mourn over the loss of your appointed festivals, which is a burden and reproach for you. Presumably the appointed festivals, they weren't ordained by God. They were no longer followed when the people were taken into exile, and the people who were firmly attached to them didn't have a part in the new nation. Just a thought. What are our appointed festivals, and how much are we attached to them? Verses 19 and 20, Zephaniah certainly ends on a triumphal note. At that time, I will deal with all who oppressed you. I will rescue the lame, I will gather the exiles, I will give them praise and honour in every land where they have suffered shame. At that time, I will gather you. At that time, I will bring you home. I will give you honour and praise among all the peoples of the earth, when I restore your fortunes before your very eyes, says the Lord. So that's Zephaniah. How can we summarise all that, and what can we take away from it? Zephaniah emphasises the nature of the relationship between God and his people. When God's chosen people of Israel weren't faithful to God, he eventually punished them, but in a way that restored the relationship. The restoration of the relationship wasn't for the whole nation, though. Only a select few, a remnant, would be part of it. The promise of restoration and salvation actually wasn't nationalistic. It was offered to the humble and penitent people in the nation who trusted in God. God's offer of salvation is very personal, and it's the same today. God offers salvation to individuals on a one-to-one basis. Those who are saved because they personally have put their trust in God through Jesus. Nobody gets saved by association. Nobody gets saved by coming to church. Nobody gets saved because their spouse is a Christian or because their parents are Christians. Those who are saved are only saved because they have personally put their trust in God through Jesus. At the same time, God also punished other nations who had been harassing his people. And the same is true today. God will eventually bring punishment on the world. And we can be as sure of that as we are that Nineveh, unlike Jerusalem, is not a city today. Nineveh is an archaeological site in Iraq. It's near the city of Mosul, but Mosul is not Nineveh. So there is no Nineveh, but Jerusalem is Jerusalem. And so we can be certain of that, just the same as we can be certain that God's promises for the future will come true. For the people who first heard Zephaniah's prophecy, the fulfillment of the restoration was a long way off, and there were few people, if any, who were living then, who would actually live to see the day. But it would come. And as the bride of Christ, we need to remember that even though the fulfillment of the vision seems to be slow in coming from our perspective, we can be confident and assured that it will arrive in due course. Jesus is coming again, and he will come in judgment. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you that we worship a God who is trustworthy, and all of your promises come true.